So, David, as we head into the summer, what's on your mind?
Besides making sure there's enough lifeguards for pools in our area, the public health emergency is going into a new phase, clearly. You and I both live in Virginia. The governor of Virginia has stated that the public health emergency will expire at the end of June. So, you know, that's going to start happening. I know we still have issues with pockets of places not vaccinated, but you and I both know there's a lot of things waiting in the wings to happen as we go into this transition.
Yeah, and I should point out that Governor Northam is a physician, so it's been interesting to see how he's navigated things. And since so much of the response to the pandemic has been left to the states, you know, the fact that Virginia, Maryland, which has a Republican governor, and the District of Columbia all sort of coordinated and really tried to work together in terms of having consistent approaches. I would say we are starting to enter, you know, the United States, this new phase. What are some of the policy-related issues that you think relate to the pandemic over, you know, that we'll be focused on over the next couple of months?
Well, there's a lot of news and policy involved, obviously. And there are a lot of things that were put in place for the public health emergency. Some of them were done at the federal level. Some of them were done at the state level. The one thing that is consistent between states and the federal government is that public health emergencies are by their very nature emergencies, and they are temporary, and they grant very wide ranging powers to executives, but they are not, you know, they do not last forever. So things will change and things will go back to some certain levels. And whether that's dining in or in a restaurant, or whether or not that means going to see your doctor in person, as opposed to a telehealth visit, there's a lot there. You know, we've just seen recently at the G7 summit where the United States and the other countries of the G7, that's Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, United Kingdom, and us, have made a pledge for a billion doses of vaccine to go to certain countries that really are in need of them and have not been able to afford them. I don't know about you, Todd. I've seen the figure that probably globally what we need is between 3 and 4 billion doses. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think also the news that Novavax, you know, that they've been successful in terms of their trials for their vaccine. So, and it has, you know, fewer restrictions in terms of temperature and things. So both the commitment of, you know, the United States and other countries in terms of providing doses of the vaccine to other parts of the world, the fact that there are other vaccine options, you know, becoming available. So it is going to be interesting. I guess I'm curious as to, from a policy perspective, before we move into, you had mentioned telehealth, and I do want to talk about that a little bit, just to sort of kind of end the discussion around the vaccines, particularly at a global perspective, how do you see things playing out over the next couple of weeks and months?
Well, I think you're going to have a lot of discussion about a couple things. You know, how much can we prepare in terms of what the rest of the world needs to make sure that all the efforts that we've gone through here don't go to vain because variants keep coming into the population? I don't mean to sound so self-serving, but the idea of stopping a pandemic is getting enough of us vaccinated so that we don't have to worry about that, which we're having troubles with and in certain parts of the country, and we are seeing things get tougher. I think we're going to see a lot more in terms of legal challenges and employers going forward. As we talk about vaccines, as they go in for not the emergency use authorization, but full authorization, when that happens, those employers are going to be in a much stronger position to say you have to be vaccinated in order to come into work. And, you know, as we saw in the United Methodist case in Houston, Houston Methodist Hospital, where federal judge just said no to a group of nurses. You have to get vaccinated. You don't have to get vaccinated if you don't want to, but you will have to get vaccinated to be able to work at this location. And we're going to probably see that battle going throughout the courts without a doubt. On the nephrology side, I think one of the things that's really beginning to become very, very much talked about, well, not talked about, it's been worked on for a while now, but we're going to see a lot more attention to looking at tests and clinical trials around transplant patients and also even some dialysis patients to really kind of evaluate where they are in terms of their response to the vaccine.
So as we sort of shift back to the public health emergency and some of the policy-related implications, obviously telehealth is probably first, second, third on a lot of people's lists. What's the update there?
Well, you know, one of the things about telehealth is it's something that a lot of groups, and particularly members of Congress, feel like it's something they can do, they can take action on. So it's not going to go away. But it's going to be a big, big discussion there. Several major bills that we've talked about that are out there, like the Connect Act. A new one arrived on the scene since we recorded our last podcast, which is the Protecting Rural Telehealth Access Act. And that comes from Senators Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Joni Ernst from Iowa, Gene Shaheen from New Hampshire, and Terry Moran from Kansas. So that's two Democrats and two Republicans. And they are going to go after, one of the things they're going to go after is making sure that parity in payment exists for audio as well as telehealth. And we've had, I think within our groups, we've had some very academic conversations about, you know, whether audio is sufficient or not. I think you're going to see a lot more of this conversation because a lot of particularly those people representing rural areas are very concerned. And the Kaiser Family Foundation just came out with a large survey that showed how much usage there was in the summer and fall of 2020 after the peak of last spring, which shows that up to 27% of all Medicare visits were telehealth. And the older the individual in Medicare was, the more likely they were to have done audio only. So that is going to be a big discussion. And at first, it looks like there's not a lot of distinction in the research between African-Americans and non-African-Americans, particularly for whites. But the catch is, when you go down into it, the numbers, the reality is that whites only say that they have about 12% of them have Medicare providers who do not do telehealth, whereas Black Americans have like close to 30%. So it seems like their numbers are kind of like on par with each other until you realize that in the African American population, there's far less access to even choosing telehealth.
David, you're raising concerns about the quote unquote digital divide. I'm curious, you know, you'd mentioned this new legislation that seems bipartisan and really focused on telehealth in rural communities. You mentioned the Connect Act. What sorts of provisions do they have to try to get to this issue of disparities in sort of access to digital information, including telehealth?
I think most of that, and that's where it's going to get really interesting, because we're also seeing the fight over the infrastructure bill that President Biden has put forth. And I think that's where the digital divide is going to really come into play. I think it's going to be somewhat nibbling around the edges in these other bills on payment policy and discretionary authority by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. I think everyone will be pushing to remove originating site requirements. I think there'll be lots of effort to try to get states to all agree on certain things, certain regulations around that, and also practicing across state lines for telehealth. Those are all very important, but the digital divide is the big kahuna. And that's the one that most people agree would probably take about $100 billion to truly address. Our members in our committees on policy and quality have really talked about this as though this is that time like the United States had after World War II when it made the decision to deal with electrifying and providing electricity access to rural America so that we couldn't have two Americas, one with electricity and one without. And while that may seem like a very dramatic comparison, a lot of our people have seen it that way. They're saying this is the same time, and it's time for us to speak really powerfully about how we need to not let this occur, because it will really truly change the way, you know, if this continues to grow, the way part of us exist and the way part of us don't have access to exist the same way. So the digital divide is critical. It is really critical. And a lot of the people in the community are really talking about the digital divide, because it's not just telehealth. Really, right now, everyone's beginning to beat the same drum, which is telehealth paired with remote patient monitoring is the real sweet spot in policy.
Yeah, and I guess I'd push back a little bit on the example of thinking about previous efforts, almost a century ago to build the infrastructure in the United States, simply because of where we are from an unemployment perspective. So at that time, unemployment was much higher, and so you had a workforce that was available to help sort of implement a lot of these goals. If there is a huge infrastructure bill that comes through, and we can argue about sort of the scope and scale, but a big piece of this, as you said, is going to be related to broadband, you still are going to need people that are going to be installing the technology, building, laying the fiber optic cable, et cetera. And at this moment in time, we don't have the available workforce to do that. So I do worry that there's going to be this commitment and there's going to be this allocation of funding, but then there's not going to be a workforce that's going to be able to execute that. And I think that's going to have, it may actually make the digital divide worse just in terms of how priority areas are established, et cetera. Again, not an area of expertise for me, but it is something that I worry about.
Well, that makes complete sense. I mean, the labor factor is there. And the labor factor is, the workforce factor is there in nephrology in many different ways. But there are a lot of pieces of the digital divide that can also be addressed that are in urban areas where the broadband capacity is there. But there are different ways in which it's accessed, and it's become so expensive. And also, really, the hope is it will also address anti-kickback statutes and Stark Law. So that, we've got healthcare providers who, and healthcare systems and hospitals and so forth, who could do remote patient monitoring with materials, equipment, that they could put in the hands of patients tomorrow, but it would be something that would be considered a financial incentive, and therefore would be, prohibited by Stark Law. So there's a lot of ways to go after this, I think, in policy. And you're right. There's going to be some areas out there that are the really, remote sections of states that are, don't have a lot of business, and business drives, the broadband cable, that whole demand. So, Todd, I mean, kind of like at some point you got to have faith in something that, we got to do something. And so I hear you. I think it's legitimate. And it's worth watching, but I think we really do need to make this commitment.
So there's a kind of great tradition in health policy in Washington that around the 4th of July holiday, the Department of Health and Human Services starts to issue a series of proposed regulations for programs, Medicare and Medicaid programs. And then over the summer, people like you and members of our various committees that are focused on these issues draft responses to those proposed rules. And then around Thanksgiving, the final rules are issued, and they're usually influenced by the comments they get, and there's tweaks and things. I'm just sort of curious, as I think about that timeline and sort of what historically has happened, if there's any update on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation models related to kidney care, just sort of what's going on there and what you're expecting in terms of future developments?
Well, we are expecting several things. First of all, the models are very much in operation. The ETC is. The voluntary model is not. In recent meetings that ASN has participated in with representatives from CMMI, they've made it very clear that the kidney care choices model, the voluntary model, is very much on their mind. They are looking for ways to make improvements to the models and to overcome various obstacles that were presented by COVID. But we've also, ASN has made a series of recommendations that can be found on the policy section of the website, the ASN website, in which we basically kind of ask them to do some very specific things, like for those listeners out there who paid attention to restore the facility fee and to change the withhold for smaller organizations from 30% That's the money that CMS holds back when it pays you its bonuses to make sure that when your data comes completely available in 2 years' time, that they haven't overpaid. So therefore, if you were calculated to get more than you should have, you won't have necessarily gotten it. You won't have to pay it back because they withheld it. But 30% is a lot. And I can't tell you how I think everyone listening to us feels about the idea that CMS needs 2 years to get its data to together. That's just kind of mind-boggling at this time point. So I think you'll see some real efforts to make some changes to participation. But what they're also saying is this summer, the Innovation Center is going to be really taking a hard look at all of their models, including the kidney models, to really examine how they impact health equity. And are the models broad enough to actually impact different audiences? Or are you capturing the same healthcare groups that are able to work in these models? And therefore, you're not really expanding out. And so health equity is not really being impacted. So I think everything's going to be examined in that way. And I think that does help with some of the restrictions in the voluntary model, because one of the arguments ASN has been making to them is they are really narrowing and limiting the number of the groups that can participate by the way they've structured some of these things financially, so that you're not getting out there into smaller communities as much as you wanted. And therefore, health equity is harder to impact if your whole population target is smaller. So we are working on that, working on improvements to that. There's a lot of discussion about how to more robustly include health equity in the ETC model, which is also already started. I don't think we'll see any rulemaking on the ETC model until next year, but we will see probably some announcements around things like the implementation of the ETC Kidney Transplant Learning Collaborative, which is required under the mandatory model, which has really got to be key to trying to help both nephrologists and dialysis facilities try to increase their transplant numbers, and it's in a critical part of the whole program. So I think we'll see a lot of that. I think there will be probably a lot more activity in the fall than we normally get with finalization of rules and ideas, because of the fact that a lot of these things are being reviewed right now with an idea towards health equity. And in particular, this summer, OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, is asking for requests for information on every aspect of how the federal government delivers its services in a way to make sure that they are there are no barriers to them. And that will be, for us in healthcare and nephrology, a very big deal, because we're going to focus very much on how the government's program structured do not necessarily provide the access we want in home dialysis, in transplantation, in smaller critical care hospitals, and just in several different other ways. So there's a lot there to keep everyone to keep their eyes open for.
So I'm going to hold you to a prediction. When do you think HHS will release the proposed rules? You have to pick a date.
I think that they'll probably be released by mid-July. They have shown a real interest in not dragging their feet as much as the previous administration did on its rules. So I would expect this to be a much faster, tighter timeline this summer.